Been examining so far what the Bible has to say about marriage and about a godly home. Started out with Christian single people and moved into Christians dating and then Christians getting married. And so far we've been really focusing in the series on marriage on exploring the idea of Genesis 2:24, the two become one flesh. And we find that concept used in different ways in the New Testament, including in Ephesians where Paul says, I reveal a mystery that we're speaking of Christ in the church. And so you can look at marriage and understand some things about Christ in the church and that relationship. And then you can flip it around and say, look at Christ in the church and what we can learn about marriage from that. And so that's really been kind of the theme that we've been exploring. And then I was thinking for this lesson, I was trying to think of some examples of godly couples in the Bible. And one of the challenges you run into, if you just start thinking about that, maybe you can let your mind wander for a minute. There are plenty of godly couples, but we don't get much of a window into their relationship, into their daily lives. We see them from kind of a high level. One of the godly couples that came to mind was Priscilla and Aquila. They're kind of a power couple of the New Testament. We meet them in Corinth. They're both tent makers. And when Paul meets them and when they become Christians, they are just on fire. They pull Apollos aside and kind of get him going in the right direction. And then we find them in several different cities. And in more than one place, Paul greets them and the house that was in their church, the church that was in their house. And so we see here's an example of a husband and wife who labored together. Paul calls them in Romans his fellow workers in Christ. So all that's great. They're an obvious hero couple in a sense. But what was their marriage like? How did they get along? What was their day-to-day life like? We don't really get a window into their family life other than that very high-level view. In fact, most of the interactions that you find, if you start thinking of them, but between husbands and wives, are more negative examples instead of positive examples. You go back to the Old Testament, you look at Jacob and his wives, Isaac and his wife, David and his wife, Solomon and his wives, on and on and on. You can find examples of husbands and wives. But very often, if we're given any details at all, it was because there was some kind of trouble going on or some kind of problem. The exception is probably the best passage we have that gives us a window into a godly home is actually in Proverbs 31 with the virtuous woman. So that's really going to be our text for today. If you would turn to Proverbs 31. It's a familiar passage, of course. Even this has some challenges to it. One of them is that it's an idealized depiction. It doesn't appear to be actually a historic person. It is a description of a godly woman, and it is focused on the wife. And so it isn't really a balanced picture of a home. But I think you'll see as we look at it, especially if we're going to try to examine it from the perspective of, if we look at this description of this godly woman, we do see references to her husband, and we can assume some things and figure some things out about their relationship based on what is said. And so really there's probably more than you realize that we can deduce about her marriage and her husband and the kind of relationship they had as we look at this picture of the virtuous woman. So what we're really going to think about is a virtuous home. And using this idealized depiction of the virtuous woman as sort of like looking through the window into this very godly home where everything is working kind of perfectly. And so it is a very idealized picture, just like saying, husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church and so forth. But we see this as an ideal, as something, a model that we can look to then say, well, how can we be like that? What can we learn from this? What principles can we learn from that to have even better, stronger marriages? Or if you're not yet married and that's something that you see in your future, how to become more like the ideal wife or the ideal husband that we see depicted in this passage. So that's what we'll be looking at. And really, I'm going to suggest three concepts that seem to me to jump out as you study through this that are important in terms of having a virtuous or an excellent home and excellent marriage. The first one is that the wife here is obviously valued. She is cherished. We see that in the very first verse, in verse 10 of this description. And Stephen, in his slideshow that was running on the TV and before, had some diamonds and this quote from this verse. Verse 10 says, an excellent wife who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. So it begins with a description of the value and it compares her to jewels. What makes a diamond valuable? Well, one thing, it's beautiful. But another thing that makes it valuable is that it's very, very rare. So you don't find them everywhere. If you did, they would lose their value. Just because that's just the way that it works. Things that are very rare, we assign a lot of value to because you know, there's gravel everywhere. But how often do you just see a ruby laying around or some kind of precious stone? They're incredibly rare. And he says that an excellent wife is very rare. Now, that's not really a slam on women any more so than would you ladies agree that a good man is hard to find. They're not everywhere. And so people often lament this, that how do you find a good woman? How do you find a good man? If you are, people in the dating world will often tell you that the world's full of people who are guys who are pigs and, people who aren't the kind of godly spouse that you would really be looking for. And finding one is probably like finding a jewel. Now, that doesn't mean that only a select few people can be the virtuous woman or the good man. The good news is everybody here can be that kind of jewel. Everybody here can be Mr. Right. Everybody here can be the ideal wife. Everybody's capable of that if we let God mold our lives. And in fact, I thought Stephen's song right before the sermon was an excellent choice. Remember what we just sang? Let the beauty of Jesus be seen in me. And so the goal of becoming a Christian is that God transforms us, conforms us into the image of His Son. And then as we let Him shape us and change us, we become like Him and we reflect His glory as we were originally designed to do, be made in His image. And as we are recreated in His image, then we become the excellent man or woman that God intends for us to be. So that's the fact that it says that she is very rare doesn't mean that it is unattainable. It just means that very few people submit themselves to the way of the Lord. Very few people choose to live the way God tells us to. Most people are more selfish and self-centered than that. And so we can all aspire to this kind of excellent life. Another purpose of this is to show the young men and the young man that it's addressed to what to value in a woman. So the instructions are saying, look, I'm telling you what makes an excellent woman. Now this is different than very often what the world values in a woman or values in a man. Very often what the world values is on a very, very surface level. Just youth and beauty and, you know, those kinds of physical characteristics are what makes somebody, especially unfortunately women, what sets them apart is some kind of physical standard of beauty. And the world says, oh, look, and they fawn over and chase after this external kind of beauty. But the passage here is saying, the Lord is revealing to this young man that it's addressed to, here's what an excellent, beautiful wife is. And it really doesn't have anything to do with these external kinds of things. It's some other things. In fact, it reminds me of what we see through Peter, where it's addressed to women, let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart, with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious. So we're thinking of a jewel is a very precious thing. And Peter reveals to us here, the Holy Spirit through Peter, that what God sees, and when He looks at somebody and He says, wow, that's beautiful, is something that's on the inside. And what Proverbs 31 is trying to help this young man do is to see things like God does. And when we see things like God sees things, we're going to find beauty in places that the world overlooks. We're going to see excellence in people that maybe the world doesn't pay any attention to. And then we're going to realize that the things that the world holds up as being so desirable are really not all that important. In fact, look down in verse 30 of Proverbs 31 where it says, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So it's the opposite of sort of the world's way of looking at it where the main important thing is just some sort of physical model of beauty. But he says those things are empty and they're not really what's important. He's revealing to us, the whole chapter, or this whole section of the chapter is describing a beautiful person from a more important and deeper point of view. And of course, if this woman is so, is of this type of inner beauty, then she should be cherished and she should be valued and she should be recognized by her family as the, you know, the wonderful thing that she is. And you see that in verse 28 and 29. Her children rise up and call her blessed, and her husband also, and he praises her. Many women have done excellently, but you surpass them all. In the way the ESV reads that, it is, that is what the husband is saying. You notice that, that if you have the English Standard Version, at the end of verse 28, there's a colon, and then verse 29 is in quotation. So it's her husband says this to her. Her husband said, there's many women out there, but you surpass them all. He praises her. And so in this principle of a godly marriage that we're looking at here, in a virtuous marriage, the virtuous wife is valued and treasured by her husband. And I would assume that every wife would want to be seen as a precious jewel and just to be treasured and valued and to hear these kinds of words and to be told and affirmed that she is valued and precious and treasured by her husband. So you see how we see even in this, even though it's focusing on the woman, there's some messages here for the men as well, for the husband, because this woman in this virtuous home, in this idealized setting of this home, she hears from her husband that she is precious and she is excellent and she is, a precious thing to him. And in fact, I think this is interesting. Hold your place there and go back to Ephesians chapter 5, where we've been really for the last few weeks. This is our passage on husbands and wives in the New Testament. And I think we can see, even in this passage, in the comparison to Jesus and the church, that the wife is cherished and is held up as something precious by the husband, even in the example of Christ and the church. Notice what we're told beginning in verse 25 of Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. I never really thought about this before, but do you see the church through Christ's eyes there, how beautiful a thing it is? Do you see what it's depicting? First of all, you see the value that Jesus places in the church. He died for her. So it was worth to Jesus to let his blood be shed for the church. And so that's the kind of love he had for the church. And then through sanctifying us and cleansing us and washing us of our sins, what he sees is he's presenting the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. But it's the idea of a bride dressed up on her wedding day, sort of, you know, in perfection. And that's what he sees, that she might be holy without blemish. But you get the clear picture here that when Jesus' view of this church, this sanctified body, is something that is very precious and valuable to him. And then he builds on that to give instructions to the husbands in verses 28 and 29. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as Christ does the church. I looked up that word to cherish, and it really comes from the idea of keeping something warm. And so you can imagine to cherish something is to keep it warm, and it's something that is loved with a tender affection. And so as we look into this, I think, look through the window sort of into this home that's depicted here, we see this very excellent wife, and we see that she is valued by her husband. He praises her. He tells her she's wonderful. And he, using the comparison of Christ and the church, he cherishes her. He has a warm affection for her. And so that's the first principle, I guess I should say, that we find of this excellent and virtuous marriage. And I think it's one that it's pretty easy to see as we think about it. That's the kind of relationship that everybody would really want to be in, and it is one that reflects the glory that God has designed for us. The second thing that we notice back in Proverbs 31 is that this virtuous marriage is built on the foundation of trust. In verse 11 it says, "The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain." The New King James, I think, says safely trusts in her. A good relationship of any kind of relationship, a business relationship. You just think, for those of you in business, any kind of relationship where you are dealing with another person has to be built on trust if it's going to be a good relationship. It's got to be one that is based on trusting the other person. And we see this trust in this marriage throughout the rest of this chapter. If you just think ahead to some of the things the wife is going to be depicted as doing, she's out in the marketplace. She's going and buying and selling and doing things. She's trusted. He's not worried about her. If you don't trust somebody, think of what that looks like. If you don't trust another person, if you're in a relationship in any sense, whether it's a family, a business, a friendship, but especially one as where you're as vulnerable and exposed as a marriage. In other words, they have a great ability to do you harm. But if you don't trust somebody, then you don't really know for sure if they're going to hurt you or not. That's what it boils down to. And so you sort of second guess them, and you don't really know what they're up to, and you don't know for sure if they're being straight up with you, and you don't really know what their intentions are, and you don't, you know, so there's this all this doubt, and there's all this questioning and second guessing and trying to wonder if they're being honest. Are they telling me the truth? Are they, and really what the fear is, are they going to hurt me? I've opened myself up and I've loved this person. Are they going to do me harm? But you see that we're told here that the, verse 12, it says, she does him good and not harm all the days of her life. So the woman in this relationship has proven herself to be trustworthy. Her husband safely trusts in her, and at the same time, she is trustworthy. She lives in a way that is that shows that she is not going to hurt him. She has his best interest in mind. She doesn't give him any reason not to trust her. And of course, as husbands, we should be the same way. We must all, you know, this in order for this trust to work, we have to always be trustworthy, which means being faithful. There's a passage that is often, or not often, but I have heard compared to the Proverbs 31 lady. Now, have you ever wondered, where's the man? Where's the passage like this for a man? I've kind of joked before that it was Proverbs 32, and somewhere along the way, it got kind of like lost. But it depicted sort of the perfect man, you know. And somebody didn't copy that one day, and it got lost. That's not the case. But Job 31 has been suggested as a nice parallel to Proverbs 31. And in Job 31, I'll provide a couple of quotes on that. Job describes himself. And here's how it begins. He says, I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? What would my portion from God above and my heritage from Almighty? What would be my portion from God above and my heritage from the Almighty on high? Is not calamity for the unrighteous and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and number all my steps? And so Job says that he has been faithful to his wife, and he has made a covenant with his eyes not to look on a virgin, not to look on others, and he recognizes that the road to infidelity begins with the eyes. The road to adultery begins in the heart. It begins in the thoughts and the mind. Of course, Jesus teaches us that as well. And he also recognizes that if to go down that path is to head toward disaster and to head toward calamity. So Job recognizes, I made a covenant with my eyes because I know where that goes. I know where this path leads of having wandering eyes. And so I'm not going to go down that path because it's just going to lead to destruction. It reminds me of Proverbs 6, which is warning about adultery. And in Proverbs 6, he says, can a man carry fire next to his chest and his clothes not be burned? Can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is he who goes into his neighbor's wife. None who touches her will go unpunished. We were watching an older movie recently with the VidAngel program that takes out kind of language and stuff like that. But in this movie, the husband was flirting with another woman, and his best friend kind of pulled him aside and kind of jerked a knot in his tail and tried to, you know, talk some sense into him. And his best friend had a quote that I thought was pretty good. He said, you're dealing with fire here. The Fidelity Bank and Trust is a tough creditor. You make a deposit somewhere else, they close your account forever. And so he's saying, hey, you can really blow this big time if you mess around with this, you're playing with danger. And it may be that it would cause irreparable harm to your relationship if you don't stop. And Proverbs 6 goes on to say the same thing. He who commits adultery lacks sense. He who does it destroys himself. He will get wounds and dishonor. His disgrace will not be wiped away. There's plenty of examples of people, and I know several personally, whose marriage has survived infidelity. There could be some here. It's possible. And I think that's when people work through something like that and they're able to do that, it reflects the kind of, grace and mercy that the Lord has for us. That's the whole message of Hosea, that God took back his people even though they were unfaithful to him. So it can be done, and I don't want to suggest that it cannot, but very often the consequences are disastrous and irreversible, and very often it is something that is a wound that can't be healed. And that's the message here of Proverbs, to recognize the danger of that. So in a virtuous marriage, the husband and the wife trust each other, and the husband and the wife are trustworthy toward each other. Not that they are perfect, because if you can only have a good marriage if you're perfect, then we're all in trouble, aren't we? Marriages are imperfect people working it out. But I think we should see that we have this very high standard that we should aim for, and we should be trustworthy to our spouses. The third point, and I really struggled to come up with the right word. I don't like that word, industrious. Sounds bad, doesn't it? Maybe you could help me think of a better word sometime. But I was trying to think, what's a good word for this third point? But if you look at the rest, the bulk of this description, so you have these kind of introductory words here in 10 and 11. Her value is far above rubies. Her husband trusts in her, and she does him good and not harm all the days of her life. And then it is boom, 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 stuff that she's busy doing. Have you noticed? It's all these things that she does. And industrious means, of course, hardworking, motivated, dedicated kind of, it are the ideas that come along with that, diligent and hardworking. And if the virtuous woman is anything, she's a hard worker. I think we would have to agree. If she's anything, she's a hard worker. Just look, kind of glance down through. We're not going to read all of it, but glance down through beginning of verse 13 and notice all the stuff that she's done, that she does there. She works with her hands. She provides food. She makes clothes. She plants a vineyard. She spins thread. She makes bedding. Somewhere in the list of all that, she finds time to teach people. She rises while it's dark. We're told, and her lamp does not go out at night. No wonder we get down to verse 27. It says she looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. She's definitely anything but idle. And I can imagine somebody saying, okay, wait a minute. Who can possibly do all this stuff? It's sort of like the Pinterest thing, right? Where there's somebody out there that has everything perfect. Their kids have the perfect outfits and they make all these wonderful meals. They turn out great. And they make their own clothes and they cook everything out of a garden they grew by themselves in their backyard, and they decorate their house. And it all it does is set you up to feel like a failure if you're not careful, because you think, I can't possibly do all these things that some superwoman can do. And I'm just thankful that if there's a male equivalent of that, I don't know what it is. Maybe I just ignore those kinds of things probably. But anyway, I think the idea here is not to make everybody feel guilty because you can't do all these things that she does. But the point is that she is hardworking and she applies herself and she uses her time and her energy to serve her home and to provide what she needs. Now, life has changed a lot since then. We don't spin thread. And, we buy clothes instead of making them by hand. Or maybe you can make them. Some people do and some people don't. That's not really the point. But the point is that she's not laying around, is she? She's not being lazy. She is a hard worker. And in fact, we can find out pretty quickly that God intended for men and women to be industrious, to be productive, to use our time productively, constructively. Even back in the garden, in the perfect setting, in paradise, before the fall, God had a job for man. Remember, he said he put the man in the garden to work and keep it, and then he made Eve to be his helper. And so even in paradise, paradise was not in a hammock. Paradise was not laying by the beach. Paradise was working and keeping the garden. It was something to do. We've been built and designed and made with creative minds, with problem-solving ability, with muscles and strength and the ability to do things. And God intended for people to be industrious. And unfortunately, there are a lot of marriages where one or the other spouse is not industrious. We have this problem described in Proverbs over and over of the sluggard. It can be the man. It can be the woman. And you've probably known of relationships like that. There are some where the dad's a deadbeat. And, you know, he's just, he doesn't do anything. And then there's others where the dad has to do everything because the wife doesn't do anything. And I can think of examples of both of those, unfortunately. And any time where one person is not industrious, where one person doesn't use their time wisely, where they prefer to kick back and lay around instead of being productive, it's going to cause tension and stress. And what usually happens is the other spouse has to work double hard. They have to pull the weight of their, you know, deadbeat other half. So we definitely don't want to be that person, right? You don't want to be the wife or the husband that your spouse is constantly frustrated with because you're not motivated to get up and do anything. Hopefully that doesn't describe any of us. It probably describes all of us to a certain degree, right? And so I think one thing to take away from this is that the virtuous woman, the virtuous family, the virtuous marriage is one where people are using their energy and using their time wisely, and they are using it to serve their family and provide the things that the family needs. Another thing that's interesting about this is that she is empowered. Look at verses 14 and verse 16. It says, she is like the ships of the merchant. She brings her food from afar. Verse 16 says, she considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. Now, a lot of times we might have thought of those as being more or less the man's job. Going out and going afar and finding things, going out and buying a field, planting a vineyard. The virtuous woman is doing those things too. Her husband trusts in her. And her husband has obviously empowered her to go out and make important decisions and to do things. And he values her wisdom and her discretion and her ability to do some of these things as well. And so I think that we see in a virtuous family, both spouses using their abilities, using their, their creativity. And it's not like where one of them says, here, you do all these menial tasks and I'll do all the important stuff. That wouldn't be making, if that was the husband's view, that here, you do all these things, and if it has anything of any importance, I'm going to handle all that by myself. If that's your view of your other half, then it's not really making a good use of the helper that God has given you. Because God has, as he did with Adam, he gave him Eve to be a helper for him. And if Adam just said to Eve, you sit over there, and I'm going to do all this stuff by myself, what kind of helper is she being? And so just like in a business or any other kind of team, it works best when everybody's strengths and values and abilities and wisdom and creativity is all utilized. And so you see clearly here, this woman is doing a whole lot of stuff. And this marriage is kind of firing on all cylinders as a result of that. And I think that that's something else that we can learn from this, that if I think everybody would want to be in a relationship where they are used and they have the ability to use their talents, and they are trusted and they are empowered and they are valued. And so all of us want to be in that kind of a relationship that where our skills and abilities are put to use. If we're a productive kind of person, we want to be in that kind of relationship. And that's the picture that is painted here for us of this strong marriage. So that's the kind of the three points that I see when I study that. You probably can find some others, I'm sure. It's a long passage. There's a lot of different things that you can see there. For instance, I didn't even get into the fact that she's generous. She opens her hands to the poor. There's a lot of those kind of things. But really what I was looking for is indications that show us the kind of marriage relationship that is depicted here. That is a strong marriage relationship. And so as we look through the window, we get this idea of this very godly, very, strong relationship and family, and it becomes the perfect foundation, for what's coming next, which we'll be getting to in the next lesson or two, which will be introducing children into the picture. Before we do that though, let's just think again for a moment about what we've said so far. So in this excellent home, in this godly marriage, what we've seen so far. We put all the pieces together. A man and a woman joined together in one flesh, permanently by God. Within that relationship, the husband is the head. The wife submits to the husband as Christ submits to the church. The husband loves his wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And then further looking into today, adding some more details to that, we see that the spouses are treasured, especially the wife. She is cherished by her husband. She is valued as valued far above rubies. He cherishes her as his own flesh. He praises her and lets her know how he, how much she means to him. We also see that this relationship is built on trust, both spouses trusting each other and both spouses being trustworthy toward each other, so that nobody has any reason to question or to doubt your intentions or your, you know, what's going to happen to them, or whether you're going to hurt them or not. There's no reason to even fear that because you're trustworthy. And then finally, when we look through the window into this godly home, we find people who are getting after it, who are industrious. And so I think each one of these hopefully challenges us to be a little bit better, to kind of improve our game, because we can all be, you can be the virtuous woman, ladies, and men, you can be Mr. Right, and you can be the sort of this godly husband that everybody would love to be married to. We all have the ability to do that if we will let as we sang, the beauty of Jesus be seen in me. If we will submit our lives to him and learn to live like he wants us to, we can have these kind of very satisfying, stable, godly homes that are the perfect environment for children to grow up in and will be a good example to those who are around us. This morning, if you need to submit control of your life to the Lord, if you haven't done that yet, this would be the perfect opportunity to do that. If you need to say, I'm ready to give my life over to the Lord, I'm ready to let him take charge. I know I've sinned and messed up and I need to be forgiven, and I want to have those sins washed away in baptism and begin walking in his light. We would love to help you do that if you will let us know while we stand and sing.